The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You've got the nearness of recession, which is closer by the day. You've got a potential emerging market meltdown. I guess if you said, well, what does it feel like? It feels like the music's been playing for quite some time. And if this game is the game of musical chairs, you may be eyeing a chair very, very eagerly. In fact, I would go ahead and grab one. If you can choose a shiny one, I would grab one of those in particular.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, David, while we were burning up here in Durango, you were burning up in the Carolinas. You did another 70.3. This time it was a relay, but it was a half Ironman. And you were doing it with a guy just a little bit younger than you. Can you tell us about it?
19 years old. I wanted to introduce my nephew to triathlons, and he did fantastic. We had a great time between the Italian food pre-race there in Chapel Hill, and Mr. Dumplings, which was amazing Chinese food in Apex afterwards. We had a fantastic weekend.
Well, and it may have been amazing mainly because you were just amazingly hungry. Yeah.
I tell you what, I was also amazingly hot. Humidity does things to the body that just normal temperature does not do. I was thinking about this on the plane back. If you've ever been in a dry sauna versus a wet sauna, a wet sauna tops out at about 125 and you're baking yourself to death at 125 in a wet sauna.
You feel like a boiled egg. Yeah.
The dried sauna, you can take it to 165 before you feel the same way. So there's about a 40-point differential between dry and wet. And it didn't matter that it was only 85 degrees outside. It was the 87% humidity, which was absolutely crushing. But we had a great time. We had a really fun time.
Dave, you've been on trips before where you've gotten a call from your wife saying, the dry season has caught up with us. We've got a fire. And you're, what is it, 1,200, 1,500 miles away. And we really did. Friday afternoon, while you were gone, we saw that wisp of smoke that just our hearts sank because, you know, we're at 30%, talking about humidity, we were at 30% of what we normally would be from snowpack and from rain. We knew we were going to have forest fires, and we're in the national news right now. You guys haven't been evacuated yet. I haven't been evacuated, but we have friends who have been evacuated. Like you said, when you got home, it smells like a campfire.
Well, I left on Thursday and had a business meeting Friday morning in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Great group. Convene and Lutheran College.
You did a commencement speech as well, didn't you?
Exactly. That night, gave a commencement speech Friday night, and it was absolutely fantastic. I learned a lot from the folks that I was with and just enjoyed the atmosphere. But coming home after this weekend, I mean, it does. It smells like a campfire. It smells like we've been camping. The forest fire north of us has gobbled up about 2,500 acres, and smoke is everywhere. So yeah. We do have a few friends that have been evacuated. We're a long ways from it, but it's a serious fire. There's no snow this winter. Right now, the fire is about 10% contained, so it's a bit of an issue.
Well, and it's a real praise that we haven't lost any structures or lives at this point. I mean, because obviously it's a very hot area, and it's fuel rich is what they call it. You know, now, you know, while you were gone also, you know, first quarter GDP numbers were released, and GDP can sound like such an incredibly dry subject. You know, we brought in Diane Coyle, who wrote GDP, A Brief But Affectionate History. It's a book completely on GDP, if you recall. But GDP is a very politicized number. In other words, not just the Obama administration, not just the Bush administration, but now under the Trump administration, we're seeing a little bit of finagling that probably is giving a misread.
Yeah, and I would encourage you to go back to the archives. If you didn't listen to the interview with Diane, it was great. Gives you some background as to the importance of GDP, how it's migrated and developed over time, what it is today versus what it was, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So we had the revised numbers last week, 2.2 versus the previous 2.3, and that's really no big deal. But the revision for intellectual property, that was significant.
I remember talking about that in 2013 when they added that.
That's right. It went from 3.6 and they bumped it up to 10.9. And that was a commentary, you're right, 2013, which is when they changed the GDP statistic and included intellectual property as a brand new component. And it was added under the Obama administration because GDP was sluggish and it needed a shot in the arm. And they literally found money to plug in. So there in the first quarter, you had the personal consumption expenditure and intellectual property, those two components making up the largest positive factors in the figure. Intellectual property was to the positive by 0.43%. And then again, the personal consumption expenditure was up 0.71. And again, it's worth remembering how we got here. And I think it's also valuable not to forget that a number is never just a number.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a message and there is oftentimes an agenda. And GDP is, as you said a few minutes ago, has long been a super politicized number.
You know, if you're a politician, whether you're Obama or Trump, obviously you're going to want to have GDP looking a little bit better. Now, you know, 43 basis points on, what is it, 2.2%. That actually is a pretty fair piece of an increase for GDP. We would have been under 2 without it, which that shows the danger. Now, corporations can do the same type of thing. They can play around and show greater profits. I'll give you an example. Okay, I got a tax refund this year, pretty good tax refund. And if I counted that as my income and say, hey, this is how my month's going, if I really counted my refund, that's really not how my month's going as far as income goes. It's something that was a tax benefit, wasn't really profit.
It was a one-off surprise. Well, last week, the Wall Street Journal, there was an article that I thought was worth reading. Maybe you can find it. Why corporate profits may be weaker than they seem.
Hmm.
And I'll quote from the article. Government data shows profits were weak in the first quarter and would have been down without the tax cut. This is from the article again. Profits for companies in the S&P 500 grew by 26.3% in the first quarter compared to a year earlier, according to Thomson Reuters. But a Commerce Department measure of corporate profits rose by just 0.1%. In the first quarter from a year ago. Take away the tax benefit and the numbers are worse. The article concludes, before accounting for the benefits of the tax cut, profits were down by 6%.
So, in other words, profits are down. They're not up. It's just the tax benefit that picked them up.
Yeah. And many times we've noted that corporations will show better than expected results in a given quarter when they're tinkering with their tax rates. And
right.
Multinationals are able to game the system in that way using what's called tax arbitrage. GE is a classic offender. IBM is a classic offender. But when you have almost as many tax accountants on your payroll as you do designers and technological engineers, what are you exactly crafting?
Mm-hmm.
And it takes effort to lower your total tax rate, but you do that via tax arbitrage.
Well, and doesn't it put them in a tough situation? Because the next time, what do they do next time? I mean, like my April tax refund won't show up this next quarter, so my profits are going to look worse.
Which raises the question, you've got the S&P 500, which again, from one perspective, had profits growing by 26.3% due to the tax cut. So the entire index was given a one-time gift.
Hmm.
And I think that's a reasonable question. What do you do for an encore?
Well, okay, looking at the stock market right now, small caps sometimes tell a story that some of the bigger blue chips don't. Small caps can sometimes be very, very exciting, both on the upside and on the downside. Now, they're getting an awful lot of press right now because the small caps are popping.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking sort of at the margins of things changing and what's really going to define the next chapter in the markets, you can look at the financials, you can look at the small caps, you can look at junk bonds, and these give you some indications of what is either developing or devolving,
mm-hmm.
evolving positively or devolving negatively. And, you know, June just seasonally is typically a tough month for stocks. But probably the most intriguing price action here in the last few weeks has been the small caps. And that right now is worth looking at. There's been a lot of hype in the press about small caps. And part of that is because they continue to set new all-time highs.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to remember that small caps are best at the beginning of a cycle in terms of growth potential. And frankly, they're the most dangerous at the end of a cycle because you're dealing with stocks that are thinly traded and have far more economic vulnerability. When you start thinking about their balance sheet strength, a lot of your small caps don't have a lot to work with in terms of excess reserves.
So where you have the greatest growth, sometimes you can have the greatest loss when that turns.
Yeah, and your largest losses are accrued in a market downturn there in the small caps.
Mm.
It's not a surprise, though, right now to see small caps roaring, but frankly, it's not a good sign. When do you buy them? You buy them at a cyclical low. You don't buy them at a cyclical high. You don't buy them after 9 years of growth. And what's interesting is investors and professionals, I would include the professional investor class in that, your money managers, they can't seem to help themselves when it comes to that siren song of momentum investing.
Momentum investing. Well, you know, that's what I think about when I hear people talking about cryptocurrencies. You know, last year, toward the end of the year, you had people who had never had an interest in cryptocurrencies saying, how do I buy some? Well, that's a form of momentum. When you know that other people that you know are buying something and making money, you feel like you have to be involved. Now, when you're a professional, you're talking about the professionals also getting sucked in to the momentum.
Well, a part of that is that professionals don't want to be seen as different because their performance and frankly their careers are at risk if they get it wrong and they're somehow different. They would rather be the same and wrong than different and wrong, because being the same and wrong means everyone is wrong and you can't get fired for that. But as a professional money manager, if you manage a mutual fund, let's say, and your fund underperforms a comparable fund by another company, that underperformance will get you fired. So you do everything that everyone else is doing, and you're constantly looking side to side, not ahead as to what the market holds, but side to side to see what everyone else is doing, because it's job security.
Last week, you talked about something that was really heating up, okay, in Italy. We were having a crisis in Europe, and it's almost as if the crisis has gone completely away this week. I think about the fire analogy. Okay, the fire broke out here in Durango. You've got smoke, you've got flame, you've got growth, you've got people looking at the news. And then if it just all of a sudden became a non-event, that's sort of what Italy felt like this week. Now, I think that can only come with buckets and buckets and buckets of new liquidity.
Right. Well, I think last week was one for the history books. And my guess is the vast majority of global market participants, that is people who are invested in the stock market but don't necessarily look at things on a tick-by-tick or moment-by-moment basis, they were yawning by the end of the week.
Sure.
Because, I mean, early in the week, you have the Italian markets melting down, but by the end of the week, you've got Italy's treasury, which has stepped in and monetized 500 million euros worth of two-year notes.
Monetized means printing.
Well, essentially, I mean, whether it's printing hard currency, which they can't do anymore, the ECB does that for them, or just creating digital ones and zeros, a credit balance, to then go take that money and buy bonds, that's what they did. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. They monetized $500 million worth of euros, the two-year notes particularly, and of course, the stock and bond market in Italy rallied back. You know, so what was happening last week? You had the Italian bond auctions, which were midweek. They were oversubscribed, and the yields were held in check.
Sure. You can do anything with a lot of money.
Now, I haven't seen the numbers yet, who participated directly or indirectly, but my guess is that the ECB and the Italian Treasury were not shy, were absolutely not shy with their checkbooks. So you've got peace and calm, which, in my opinion, are not always what they seem. The perception management there in Italy last week, frankly, it's an extension of the theme from the last decade, at least a decade, where, again, there's almost no other period in financial history like this, where perception management via the central banks and direct intervention in the marketplace brings peace and calm, at least on the surface.
Dave, I was flying back from a conference that you and I had had years ago, and I was alone on the plane. I typically will put the headsets on and listen to the pilots. You know, some people listen to music, but I like to plug in if they're turning the mics on and listen to the pilots, because being a pilot, I like to hear how the whole thing works. And I remember being on, let's call it flight 262. I won't name the airline because this would embarrass them, but I was listening on the headset and I could hear Kansas City Center calling our flight. And our pilots were not answering. And I heard them about a minute later calling, and our pilots weren't answering. This went on for about 4 or 5 minutes. And finally, I was sitting near the back of the plane. I just quietly called one of the flight attendants over, and I said, hey, would you please call the pilots and let them know that Kansas City Center is trying to reach them? You know, sometimes a pilot might be on a different frequency, whatever. Well, her reaction was really strange. She all of a sudden was trying to manage me. She says, sir, you're going to have to be quiet. You're going to scare the passengers. And she immediately went into perception management, because that's really what her job was. I was just simply saying, you might want to tell the pilots to start listening to the radio. But her idea was to control. And I can understand that. They don't want to panic the passengers. This wasn't an emergency situation. But I realized at that point that it was more important to her to manage the perception of the cabin than actually solve a problem that may be happening with the pilots.
One of the differences between the financial markets and the plane is that if you do freak out in the cabin, there's really nowhere to go. It's not like you're going to run to the door,
you're a yank captive
the
audience.
Door. Yeah. You're going to yank the door and jump out because there is no exit, right? I mean, so you may freak out internally and you may cry and scream and yell and throw a temper tantrum, but what are you going to do? In the financial markets, you can cry and scream and yell, but you do have a second choice, and that is get out, sell whatever asset class you're not interested in. So that you've got the modern era of finance, which depends on the sentiment of the public remaining on balance positive.
Stay calm.
Right. So the work of the central banker and the central planners has included impacting prices at strategic moments in time when that sentiment is shifting too far to the negative side of things. And last week was masterful. Mm-hmm. It was masterful. Just for perspective, think about Greece. Think about the difference between Greece and Italy. Greece entered the crisis 2010 to 2012 with debt to GDP of 109%.
Okay, so their debt was 109% of their annual GDP.
And Italy was at 102. That was 10 years ago, mm-hmm. roughly. Italy's official numbers are now closer to 130%. So, you know, obviously they've taken on more debt or their economy has slowed. And I think actually their economy is about 8% below where it was before the global financial crisis started.
And that's counting everything that they owe?
Well, no, it doesn't include what the country owes to the Germans because most of your target two balances are a liability to the Germans. Mm. And that figure adds another 26% to the debt to GDP figure. So the Italians are actually closing in on about 160% debt to GDP. Doug Nolan discussed the target two balances over the weekend as $426 million.
Almost half a billion bucks.
That's what the Italians own. And that's nothing to sneeze at. So the question, if you look at the volatility of last week and you look at the hemorrhaging in the bond market, and then of course it's fixed because of debt monetization and whatever. My question is, what structured products got blown up last week? Because you've got bond market volatility, which was immense. The German 10-year bund dropped from a yield of 58 basis points to 18 basis points. People were clamoring to get into German bonds. You had the 2-year German bund reached a negative 82 basis points last week.
That's a flight to liquidity. We talked about that with the dollar, but that's also with the euro, these short European bonds.
Absolutely. What you saw was sentiment, which was, you know, sort of getting close to seeing the whites in people's eyes, feeling the panic, and it was there. When you start seeing those credit spreads widen to the extreme that they did last week, when you begin to see people panicking from one area within the fixed income and clamoring for another, liquidity was on order last week in a major way. And again, credit spreads told you that we were on a crisis footing. But don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by the Italian Treasury monetizing debt and thereby purchasing a moment of peace and calm.
Sometimes it's good for us to look back and go, okay, let's remember back a little ways. Let's go back a decade. Let's go back 15 years. I remember billboards all over the place for Deutsche Bank because during the Krispy Kreme craze. Now, do you remember when Krispy Kreme was, I mean, it was just as hot as cryptocurrencies are now. And Deutsche Bank was saying this was our investment. And so they put their name right beside Krispy Kreme. And I remember, you know, going back to May of 2007, Deutsche Bank stocks, I mean, they were soaring. They got up to almost $120 a share. I think it was 119 something a share. They were the hot, hot commodity. And then, of course, when the financial crisis hit 1 year later, they became a danger. And now, did I hear correctly that the FDIC now has them on the watch list for problem banks?
Well, that's right. Both the Fed and the FDIC are scrutinizing the German giant, and it's probably because of derivative bets and counterparty exposure.
Well, let me just say their share isn't 120 anymore either.
No, it's floating around 10 or 11.
Yeah. And
so it's a little bit different today than it was then. But you mentioned cryptos. Maybe they're the new Krispy Kreme donuts. I remember sitting out at Joshua Tree. This was a college weekend, and we went climbing out at Joshua Tree almost every weekend. I was not very good at doing homework. Well, I did all my homework on Sunday night after we got back from a weekend of climbing. And I remember sitting around the campfire, and we were making commercials for Krispy Kreme donuts. And just kind of, you know, the cop walks up to the car and he's getting ready to write somebody a ticket and he looks inside and he sees a box of Krispy Kremes and he was getting ready to say, you know, you realize you were going 20 miles. Is that
Ooh.
a Is that a crispy?
Is that a Krispy Kreme
donut? And in the next scene,
and it had to be a cop. That's cool.
And the next scene is the driver driving away with a smile, and the box is partly gone. Of course, you know, but there was a little bit of a negotiation. The ticket went away, and anyways.
The analogy, crypto creams. Maybe we'll start calling them crypto creams. We're going to get a lot of comments.
I know. Well, I mean, the issue with Deutsche Bank is a big one. And you wonder if an entity like Deutsche Bank, of course, they have very close political ties in Germany, would they ever be allowed to have their own version of a Lehman moment where all of a sudden it's liquidity driven and they move towards a solvency crisis and it has to be solved very quickly by outside intervention?
Well, could Deutsche Bank just be another Italy? I mean, can the European Union just step in and save everything?
There's a question hanging over the markets last Monday. Of course, Tuesday is when things started to go haywire. But on Monday, you had Draghi and Merkel, who had an unscheduled meeting. And you wonder if the derivatives daisy chain isn't beginning to unwind. Mm-hmm. And again, you've got indications of stress and strain and indications of market panic. Deutsche Bank is under pressure. Italy is foundering. And of course, there's a political dynamic there. But again, that derivatives daisy chain, when it begins to be unwind, the question is always who's next and who's intertwined or interconnected to those who are being bruised and battered. It's really the job of central bankers to care for the banking system. I mean, they can talk about the economy, they can talk about employment, but when push comes to shove, central bankers take care of bankers, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, caring about banking system liquidity and solvency, that I think has to be at the top of their mind this week. And look, if a major institution is lost, you know others will go with it. Look at the stock price of Deutsche Bank. It is at levels that we haven't seen since 1992. I mean, so liquidity issues, they morph into solvency issues very fast. You can ask Dick Fuld about that. You know, when he was running Lehman as the CEO, on a Monday, he said, everything's fine, we've got plenty of liquidity. On a Friday, their doors were closed. Mm-hmm. And was he lying on Monday? No, that's how fast liquidity becomes a solvency issue. And you literally, you know, you face your extinction event.
Okay, so we talked about going back, let's say 15, 16 years and just reminiscing. Okay, let's go back 25 years, 26 years. I mean, what were you doing when Deutsche Bank stocks were at this level?
I was packing my bags for college. I mean, you could say own stocks for the long run, you know, but if you bought Deutsche Bank then, I mean, it's been one heck of a roller coaster ride. I don't mean to take that theory and completely trash it, owning stocks for the long run. There is a great case for owning stocks for the long run, but I think it hinges on owning the right stocks, number one, and number two, capturing a more ideal cost basis. Because if you bought at 11, 12 and rode it to 120, that's one thing. But if you bought it at 80, 90 or 120 and have been riding it down to $11, isn't that a little different?
Well, and doesn't that disqualify the current trend of passive investing? I mean, the price paid on entry is still very, very important. And the price you get on exit is also important.
Yeah, I mean, you can't ignore the price paid on entry into the market. An ill-timed entry into the asset class means you're going to have to wait longer. And the patience variable is something that is regularly tested. I mean, most investors can't wait or choose not to wait. There's a part of this that, of course, if you're a dollar cost averager, you know, there's an argument for that. And it's a consistent routine savings and investment program. You know, you're not trying to time the market or time a perfect price. And there is value in the consistency, just like there's value in consistently training for something or practicing an instrument or whatever, there's a cumulative effect which may even override the perfectly timed market. But I would still argue that it matters where you're at in a cycle. And right, if you can figure out where you're at in a cycle, that's very helpful.
Well, and you mentioned dollar cost averaging and knowing where you are in the cycle. You never once mentioned what your neighbor's doing. And we had talked before about momentum investing. Most people want to do what their neighbor's doing, especially if it looks like it's successful. But if you are dollar cost averaging and you understand to a degree, you're not going to perfectly know the cycles, but if you can understand to a degree what's cheap and what's overvalued, sometimes you're going to be early, sometimes you're going to be late. Actually, most of the time, you're going to be early, though, with a habitual investing practice.
I would rather be early.
Yeah.
Frankly, it's why being early is better than being late for a particular investment theme. In either case, you're going to have to wait. In either case, you're going to have to wait. On the one hand, you're looking for a catalyst for a thesis. On the other, you're waiting for recovery of losses after a thesis is already in motion, but may be tested and, you know, with downside losses. And all of a sudden you're dealing with the tolerances that you as an individual investor have, you know, really being tested. What can you endure? What can you endure? Patience either way, but I think patience for those who are early is better than the patience game that you have to play when you're hoping to break even again. Look, we've been in business for 46 years. And the majority of our precious metals clients own gold well under $1,000 an ounce. Mm-hmm. Silver well under $8, $10. Let's say, though, you came to the market in 2011 and 2012. Your patience is tested in different ways than the person with a lower cost basis.
Sure.
Even though the thesis for investing in precious metals may have been identical, the psychology of the investor who arrived late is far harder for that investor to manage. And frankly, it becomes less rational over time due to the degree of pain. And if you're experiencing sort of doubt about, was I right? Did I do the right thing? All I know is that it's not working. And over time, that doubt sort of compounds on itself.
You know, yesterday when I was at lunch having my espresso, okay, that we talked about, I was reading a study.
Was an Italian roast.
I got to tell you a story about that. Okay. Last week, I'm totally chasing a rabbit here. But okay, last week after we named the show, you know, because you had brought out that it was the Italian roast, and I think we said in the subtitle that it was bitter for the world. Well, I told the guy who serves me espresso, this guy's name is Benjamin, and he really takes his craft seriously. I love a barista that takes espresso seriously. I've had one in the afternoons for decades. And last week, you know, there are times when he'll time me a 19-second espresso and a 21-second espresso and say, okay, taste the difference. And he's really interested, or there's a new roast that comes in. But I told him what we named the show, and he said, oh, you use the word bitter with an Italian roast? He says, oh, you're going to get comments. And sure enough, we looked at the comments. Okay, let me just read you this comment. And Joel, you know who you are, but he says, it's not burnt. I repeat, not burnt. When it comes to coffee, Italians like it darker, but it's not burnt. Now, I'm not going to read Joel's last name over the air, but I will tell you it's an Italian name. Now, okay, so back to the story. I was having my espresso yesterday, and I was reading a study on willpower that was really fascinating, Dave, because willpower, I think we a lot of times beat ourselves up for not having enough willpower. But if you don't frame your life with successful habits where you're not having to make a new decision about everything, you're going to fail. Because willpower, and this is what the study, it was by a guy named Baumeister, and other people have done this study, but he says there's a limited reserve, a finite amount of willpower throughout the day. If you make decisions willpower-wise early on, you become more and more fatigued. And a good example of that is, I hate to shop. Okay, some people love to go for hours and just look at things. Well, for me, I'm making a decision continually, and I'm exhausted at the end. Well, that's this expression of making these decisions. Now, I tie this in with this, because you've got the psychology. You said the psychology of the investor who arrived late is far harder to manage.
Right.
What you and I have both found is some people will check the prices all day long and re-question whether they've got the right investment all day long as they watch the market go up and as they talk to Joe down the street. And it's an exhausting process. Now, you were talking about dollar cost averaging. You were also talking about knowing the cycle. You've also, in past commentaries, talked about compartmentalizing your life, whether you're going to be a prepper for 10 minutes. Okay, for 10 minutes, go ahead and do your preparations, or an hour or whatever. Then put it aside. Same thing with investing. If you're checking the price all day long, you're actually, in a way, you're taking out of that willpower reserve. Am I making any sense?
Well, yeah. And I mean, again, going back to the gold market, it doesn't matter for the person who came late. You know, again, 2011, 12, 13, it doesn't matter that gold and silver are well off their 2015 lows. It doesn't matter that if you're looking at a chart, it's building a massive base for growth in the next few years.
It was still a reasonable decision.
And they may feel like, well, I'm still in the red today. So they're dealing with the psychology of being a one-time quote-unquote believer in a particular thesis. And now they've turned to sort of a skeptical, you know, whatever. But keep in mind, facts are a part of the fabric of reality. Mm-hmm. Feelings add color to the picture. And in many instances, it's unhelpful color. So, I mean, nevertheless.
It's an emotional drain.
Right. Well, it is. In the chart trend lines for gold and silver, they've held up very well.
Mm-hmm.
Sentiment is in a range where you would expect a strong rally. But again, the psychology is different. Someone who's owned gold for 20 years versus someone who's owned gold for only the last 5 to 7.
Mm.
And it's worth taking account of who you are, because you don't want to make a mistake in the interim. Say, all right, I'm just done. I'm done. I waited long enough. What is long enough? What is long enough? What makes you think that your timeline is the appropriate timeline? I mean, I look at what's happening in Europe and I think to myself, they are desperate to hold things together. And I admire their resolve to keep the whole euro structure in motion. I understand why the ECB and why the powers that be in Europe want this to survive.
Sure.
They're fighting an uphill battle.
Well, you'd probably do the same thing if you were in their position.
Absolutely. But the challenge is going to be ultimately if it's workable or not. Right. So do you have the patience to sit around and see? You know, some people will, some people won't. But I think this is where over the next year or two, many of the imbalances in the financial markets, both overseas in the emerging markets here in the United States, they will be revealed, and they'll be revealed in ways that are beyond the capability of the central bankers to manage. And in that moment, again, it's were you early? Were you late? And if you're late, you're chasing prices again. If you're early, you have to be patient. You have to be willing to be patient. I am, and I'd encourage investors to be.
Let me restate what I think you're saying. I mean, if you're an investor in gold and silver, cyclically, you're in a good position. If you're an investor, though, let's say you own small caps right now.
Right. So back to the small caps today. I mean, the investor that may attempt to go the distance, you know, they're long-term investors. They want to own small caps. They're buying today. Obviously, the decision is colored. Again, there's an emotional aspect to this. It's colored by enthusiasm. There's a present tense sort of ebullience in the market. But the odds are they've just bought at the high and they're going to be forced to stubbornly hold. I know the rest of the story here, and I think most investors do too.
Mm-hmm.
They'll hold until the pain is so great that they throw in the towel and it'll be somewhere near the lows. Now, keep in mind, small caps, the NASDAQ is along for this ride too, setting new highs. And as we see capitulation in the market, again, you've got investors who are current tense. They're buying a momentum trade and they'll hold and they'll hold and they'll hold and they'll hold. I will tell you that most people bought it on the basis of emotion and not on the basis of fact. So the contrast here between the small cap investor today and even the gold and silver investor of 2011 and 12, it may have been an ill-timed purchase, but ultimately there's veracity in the thesis, and the reality that there is fact basing it will serve you well. I'm not so sure that buying small caps at the top of a cycle is a good idea ever.
I got a call from a client that I hadn't talked to in 17 years. We had lost track of each other. He had moved and he didn't call with updated information. It was wonderful to talk to him, but he had purchased from us in 1999 and he sold. He had to sell. They were buying property. He sold in 2001 and he took somewhat of a loss, but we were lamenting because the crowd in 2001 was very similar to the crowd today. With gold. Most people today would say, oh, why would you be in gold? 2001 was the same way. And he was talking to me on the phone and he said, Kevin, I made a huge mistake. He said, I would be up fourfold right now if I would have just held the gold that I purchased in 1999. But the crowd was not saying that. Now, like I said, he had to sell. He was buying property, but he actually was following the crowd at the time, too. I remember the conversations, and he said, you know, it's over for gold. Y2K didn't happen. That was his reasoning. It's over for gold, and I need to sell.
Well, the real tragedy here is that by the time gold and silver hit their peaks over the next few years, he will have missed not just a fourfold move, but from his cost basis, what would have been a 15 or 20-fold move.
Mm.
There's a normal pattern for investors. They buy when there is crowd support
right.
for what they're doing. And you've got the support of the media. You've got the support of a broadening investor base. And you get positive feedback. Positive feedback everywhere you go. And you're getting positive feedback from Wall Street. That adds to the context for what we've sometimes called the greater fool purchase, which is, you know, is buying high and hoping that someone else comes in mm-hmm. to pay an even higher price than you did. That's the greater fool theory of investing. Very few people, this is the opposite of the normal pattern for investors. Very few people are willing to buy low because they risk being alone.
Yeah.
They risk being alone. Most people think and act in mass. It's the minority that are willing to step outside of their current cultural milieu and risk isolation. that is truly a minority.
Isn't that why we love the maverick scientist who breaks out of the mold, or the maverick artist? A lot of art that we appreciate today was not appreciated at the time by the culture, because the culture, it didn't fit into the norm.
The fact that we have breakthroughs in any field of endeavor means that there is a certain pattern that develops within every field, and that pattern is something like a rut. And then all of a sudden, there is the opportunity, whether it's the artist or the scientist, they're willing to look at things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And often, they're willing to borrow an idea or an influence from a different field and introduce a fresh insight or a fresh perspective mm-hmm. into what they're doing. I mean, part of the reason I believe we've gone so far down the rabbit hole of debt-driven growth is that all the experts share a common base of knowledge. There are very few independent thinkers. As I think about the current trend, you know, towards moving kids into science and math, I mean, if you look at everybody wants computers and science, and that's great. But do you realize the advantage that you have on a broad base, a societal base, when you have a quote unquote liberal arts education, where people have studied literature and history and philosophy? Even if you're a scientist needs to know literature, right? And the writer needs to know something about science. And when you cross-fertilize, that's when you have a dynamic which brings in new and fresh ideas. I mean, Wall Street today, by and large, is a place driven by consensus.
Right. They have a system, and they all want to look the same.
But that describes the whole world we live in. I mean, beyond Wall Street, beyond those streets, Wall and Broad in downtown Manhattan, consensus is what you study when you focus on any one field to become an expert.
Mm.
There's nothing wrong with being an expert, but understand that you've learned a consensus view. You learn consensus views, and very rarely do you find an academic. And again, this is, academics live in a peer-reviewed world. Everything that you do is under the microscope from people who've studied the same things, and they want to see how well you studied what they studied, and they check the box and say, okay, you're okay with us.
Well, you have to get published. Okay, now you introduced me to Thomas Kuhn's book on scientific revolution, and it has nothing to do with staying in the norm. In fact, sometimes we ask ourselves, as humans, is this normal? That question right there is a very non-creative question.
Well, if it is damaging, it's damaging to the status quo. If it's dangerous, it's dangerous to the status quo. And that may or may not be truly damaging or dangerous. But Kuhn describes these kinds of consensus outlooks as textbook enclaves. That's more or less the language that he uses, where no one breaks free of myopic thinking until the textbook answers are failing mm-hmm. in area after area after area. And as you start counting up all the failures, you just think to yourself, well, then what's in the textbooks is wrong.
You know, Einstein did that. When Einstein had his major breakthrough back in 1905, as far as relativity, you know, the first special relativity and then later general relativity, he was not studying physics. He was actually imagining himself on the front of a light beam. He also was studying strange math that a guy named Riemann came up with that had to do with what they call it tensor math, but really all it is it's topology, it's shapes. And what it did, it changed his idea of gravity. It changed his idea of light. And he started thinking about space as possibly curved, like this topology that was, these guys in the 1860s, when Riemann came up with this math, they didn't think it really existed in the real world. They just thought it was an interesting math logic concept. It turned out that it revolutionized the way we look at the universe.
Well, there's the revolution in thinking, borrowing from another idea or field and bearing the benefit of that in your own.
Well, consensus actually transitions not just from science, not just from the arts, but in investing. But the Federal Reserve, okay, how many academic economists are at the Fed? You've mentioned that in the past. It's hundreds, isn't it?
700 PhDs. 700 PhDs work for the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
And I was interested to read that Ms. Brainard, who's one of the Fed members, she's gone here recently from being a dove to being a hawk this year. That is, all throughout the Obama years, there was a firm argument from her for accommodation and for easy money, and now she sees the need to raise rates.
Okay. Now, let me just point something out, though, Dave. Do you remember, three, 4 years ago when Obama was in office, we went back and looked at the statistic as to how many Federal Reserve members are Democrats? liberals. And it turned out it was over 90%. I can't remember the exact number, but it was over 90%.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting because that may or may not be a factor at all in her perspective. The switch from dove or market supportive to more, you know, tightening of liquidity and market restrictive, that switch may well be because of unemployment stats and inflation targets being hit.
But do you think it could be of the elections that are coming up as well?
I don't know. I mean, you do have the employment number, which shrunk to 3.8, actually 3.75% to be precise. That's the best number since December of 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Let me repeat that. Best number since December of 1969, because that's ironic that that was the first significant year of decline, 1969, in equities since 1949. So you had about a 20-year stretch of boom, right? And the statistics were the very best just before they went into the 1968 to 1982 inflationary bear market.
So let me repeat so I understand. The employment number right now, it's as good as it's been since 1969, and that was the peak of the market. Now, again, we don't believe the employment number. We know that they doctor that, but the official employment number right now, 3.8%, is the best we've seen since 69.
That's right. And again, I think statistics are usually very good, very, very good, just before a major turn. Certainly that was the case in the 68-69 inflationary bear market in stocks.
Okay, but let me go back to the political. I mean, could we see some monetary slash political decisions coming up here in the next few months based on the idea of maybe getting more Democrats in Congress?
I hope that Brainard and the other Fed chiefs are operating according to the numbers, but there is a small possibility that it's political. As a Democrat, if you put yourself in her shoes, it would be frustrating to see Trump getting credit for positive economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stripping away one of the easy critiques of the current administration as you head into the midterm elections. And, you know, again, the more restrictive you get with monetary policy, the less oxygen there is in the system and the more likely the financial markets begin to convulse. Let's just say it's helpful if you're a Democrat with aspirations for November to begin to see some hiccups in the stock market. And certainly, as history would be our guide, the more restrictive you get with monetary policy, the increased odds of that, they get higher and higher.
Okay, but she still has an argument. She could say, you know, I've done this for a long time, Dave. I think I'm credentialed enough to stick with the numbers and stay objective.
Well, she is credentialed enough to stick with the numbers. And the thing that makes me question this is I think about her experience as Undersecretary for the Treasury for International Affairs. Right. So she understood international affairs and the Treasury Department and the impact of what we were doing on overseas entities, countries, companies, what have you. And it should have given her a greater sensitivity to the impact of a strong dollar on the rest of the world.
Right. So if she's going hawkish, she's really going strong dollarish.
Right. When rates are rising, the dollar generally is strengthening, and that creates a crushing pressure for the emerging markets. And for her to ignore that, or at least diminish the importance of a flattening yield curve here in the U.S., it makes me wonder why.
Well, you know, okay, we talk about politics and objectivity. Nancy Pelosi, of course, one of the most objective people that we know, she said strong employment numbers really don't mean anything. They mean very little.
That's just totally downplaying the positive jobs numbers just out. Yeah, exactly. Strong employment numbers mean little.
Okay, so
that's interesting.
We have small caps hitting highs. We've got unemployment hitting lows that we haven't seen since 1969. In one way, you could say, gosh, this thing is going really, really well. And then on the other side of things, you could say, well, anytime that's happened in the past, you're right on the edge of a recession. Is there a way of measuring timing? People love to ask about timing. Is there a measure that can give us an idea of when this cycle changes?
Yeah, I think January is a great picture of this for us because, you know, in January you had the volatility index, the VIX, getting to single digits again. And we've been pounding the table for months. Look, the lower it gets, the closer you are to crisis. Now, the lower the VIX gets, the volatility index, what it suggests is there is no trouble on the horizon whatsoever. No one is hedging their bets in the stock market because there's no need to, right? So the volatility index, it's better and better and better and better just before it blows up, right? So to say, hey, we're in a really good place, frankly, it means nothing. It means that you're in a very, very dangerous place. Bank of America runs a list of 19 indicators that signal recession. What about 80% of the indicators are triggered? your recession is alive and well. You're in the middle of it. You've got 13 of the 19 which have triggered thus far. So, look, we're waiting for two more, and then we have sort of that issue of the past echoing into the present. The context is set. You've got the Fed tightening. You've got the nearness of recession, which is closer by the day. You've got a potential emerging market meltdown, which is ever closer, with the tightening of monetary policy in motion. I guess if you said, well, what does it feel like? It feels like the music's been playing for quite some time. And if this game is the game of musical chairs, you may be eyeing a chair very, very eagerly. In fact, I would go ahead and grab one. If you can choose a shiny one, I would grab one of those in particular.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.